Ladies and gentlemen, for those of you who haven't finished lunch, bon appétit on the remainder of your meal. But we'll try to give you some different nourriture right now. I'm delighted to introduce this working lunch panel entitled Water and Agriculture in U.S. Foreign Assistance. And to help guide us here, we have two superb panelists. We'll begin with James Frantskevich, whose credentials are in the program that you have. His is notable because it lacks a picture. We should have found a way to do that. But he has over 30 years of professional experience, 20 of those years working overseas with USAID, a wealth of information on a whole range of issues involving water and foreign assistance. In addition, I'm delighted to welcome Michael O'Neill, USAID, and Michael is National Program Leader for Water Resources there. So we have the makings of a very interesting conversation on where things are going with respect to U.S. foreign assistance and the role of water going forward. Both our participants here have kindly agreed to lay out where things are and where things are going in their respective agencies. And then even though we're not really well configured for a conversation here looking at you, nevertheless, I'd like to pepper them with a few questions, and no doubt you would like to help contribute to that process. What we'd like to do is to make this as transactional as possible. The game plan is to try to catch up a little bit with our agenda here, so we'll try to be as abbreviated as we possibly can. So, as you're finishing your lunches or moving into dessert, let me begin with you, Jim, if you would, please. If you could let us know from your perspective where things are going. Thank you again, both of you, for participating in this lunch.
Okay, thank you, Eric. Now, I'm just going to give a brief overview of where things are in aid right now, and as far as agriculture and water are concerned. We have programs that have been running on water for the poor, and those programs for water for the poor have been primarily focused on drinking water and sanitation. And so that has been that has been our earmark language, actually. And so we've had to spend last year all the money USAID had went to WASH, which meant water supply sanitation. This year now there's money because of the food security issue, and so there's $450 million coming this year off the hill for agriculture. So we have issues between agriculture and water that we're going to address, but we always have these earmarks that sometimes too narrowly define what we're going to do. Now, that kind of explains where we're at today. So we have $450 million coming in agriculture in 2009. We have $300 million coming in water in 2009. And those monies are programmed across the world. They're programmed by missions. We have regional bureaus. The regional bureau, like for Africa, the regional bureau for Asia, have negotiations with those missions. Those missions then, in turn, have negotiations with country host government officials, and they determine sectors they're going to work in, and primarily they would be looking at some of them are going to have to work in water, and some of them are going to work in agriculture, and sometimes the two of them are not going to join up because they're two separate goals, so to speak, for the money that's happening. Now, just to look at how USAID functions overseas with other government agencies, we usually have interagency agreements and we bring in others. And so USDA typically is a partner for USAID when we're working on agricultural projects. We wind up, USAID has the money for foreign assistance. And so that means more or less all the other government agencies come through us. And it's up to the missions and the project managers to determine what expertise we need, what government agency. And so, say you could go to the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation to get dam safety investigations or training. You could go to USDA to get ag research. You could go to EPA to get water quality. You go to USGS to get surface water or groundwater. So that's kind of the structure of things. Other government agencies don't get money for international work. Now, Mike may say that's wrong, that he does get some money because he does international work, but for the most part, the money comes through USAID. We determine doing the interagency agreement. We sign that agreement with the other government agency. They come in and do the technical work for us and turn over. And it can be something as simple as coming in and doing an assessment of groundwater, the needs, a recommendation on how to proceed, and then we do a project. Sometimes it would be through the USGS. Sometimes it would be through a consulting firm. So that's kind of the general background of how we're working. And that's the funding that we're looking at right now in 2009. And you should also be aware that USAID used to do a lot of rural development work, but that was, I started in 87, and that was kind of the end of rural development work as far as USAID. And then there was a period of, I'm not sure, probably private enterprise would be the best way to characterize it. And now, because of the food security, agriculture is coming back. And so if you think about, there's been a hiatus of for 20 years, we've been out of agriculture, and we're just coming back. Okay.
Mike.
Well, I would agree with Jim. We are not, USDA is a domestically focused organization, and our department primary mission is the global competitiveness of U.S. agriculture. We do, however, have some of the largest science units in the world working on agricultural problems and particularly on water and agriculture. The Agricultural Research Service, the Economic Research Service, and through my own agency, the Cooperative State Research, Education, and Extension Service, we have all the land-grant universities at our, not quite at our beck and call, but they work with us as partners to solve some of these water issues. Excuse me. One of the major things that we're very interested in right now is agricultural water security in the United States and how that impacts the global environment. We're very concerned that if we continue to see water shifting away from agriculture, we won't be able to produce sufficient food for our own country. And there is a fairly big challenge to producing, to meeting the food requirements of our country as well as the rest of the world. For perhaps the first century and a half of our nation, we've exported food more than we've imported, but over the last few years, we've actually had months where we've imported more food crops than we've exported. And that's a big shift for the U.S., which means the global markets are, they're actually working quite well, but it also changes the way we think about food and food security in our own nation as well as globally. In order to meet our water security needs, we've actually focused on five or six major issues. General conservation is certainly one that is critical, and that's got to be done at a watershed scale. We're very interested, and we still have major efforts in irrigation efficiency that I think have a global perspective, and we heard a lot about that today. We're investing very heavily in biotechnology, and I think the challenges of biotechnology are obvious, but the solutions can be very dramatic as well. And just recently we've tried to work, and we're beginning a partnership with Monsanto to talk about how can we look at drought and saline-tolerant crops and what might that be able to do to improve productivity on agricultural lands. Drought preparedness is certainly one of the major issues as well for U.S. agriculture. We have to stop mitigating the effects of drought and start preparing to deal with them ahead of time, recognizing that drought is part of the global climate cycle, and how we respond to that in agriculture is going to be critical to how we manage our water over the next few decades. We need to do a better job of economics and water markets, and that's been a major effort for us for the past few years with our partners at Economic Research Service. And then we're actively moving into the use of recycled water in agriculture. Many other nations have done this quite well, and the U.S. has only had a limited effort in this area, and particularly in California and Florida, but we believe that this is going to be a major source of water, really trying to match the right water, the quality of the water, to the actual crops that it produces in the U.S. And so even though our mission is very focused on the domestic issues, we believe that our international presence and how those are linked across the globe will be a major factor in the coming years.
Well, thank you very much. Before we open this up to general discussion, I'd like to ask you both a handful of questions to get your perspectives, to try to round things up, building on the points that you've raised and also on our discussion this morning. The first one is looking forward into the future. We heard a lot about trends in different areas of the world and a number of the key issues associated with water and the link between water and agriculture. But it would be very useful to get your perspective in terms of looking out to the horizon. Which areas of the world do you see under the greatest water stress? Where are the dislocations most profound from your perspectives? Jim, would you begin on that one, please?
Right now we have a focus on Africa, and it's a number of different things driving that, but mainly it's due to a lack of investment in Africa. And so our water program, our priority right now is Africa. I believe that our ag program, our food security, is going to have a high priority for Africa. There's work in Central America and there's work in South Asia. And those are the areas right now that USAID is focusing on as far as priority areas, as far as agriculture and water. Now, at the same time, there's going to be spot cases of like Haiti, or there's other places that we're working in. India has a groundwater energy and agriculture nexus. So those three areas that I mentioned would be the primary ones as far as USAID's focus. Now, having said that, again, countries will rise up for a variety of reasons. And if you look at Africa, for example, I mean, the work we were doing was Sudan and Ethiopia, and it was based more on relief and refugees. And that would be water and agriculture. And so if you ask me which areas, we have some main areas to focus on, but primarily it usually comes down to relief activities that drive a particular country focus.
And I would just add to that, I think even one of the earlier speakers today, that China is a major area where water issues will be a big problem in the coming decades, particularly because of the linkages between water quality and water availability. Many of the food crops we're growing, at least in our country, we use fairly high-quality water, but difficulties with finding that kind of high-quality water in China, I think, will be a major issue. And so trying to produce a clean water supply for agriculture is going to be a major challenge in that country.
Now, we've already talked about the kind of implicit tensions between short and long range, immediate and urgent versus more systemic policy targets. We've also talked, or at least implied, a little bit about the process by which U.S. policy is formulated and carried out, and how the various agencies work together. As we look at this, as we look at the U.S. government's response to the broader water and agricultural challenges around the world, where do you see strengths and weaknesses? What kind of balance sheet in terms of our capacity to move forward in the kind of environment that we heard about this morning and that we'll hear more about this afternoon? How would you assess where things are organizationally?
For us, funding is what drives everything. And funds, if they're given to us over a long period of time and a directive to start on a program on food security, if you tell people that this is the amount of money and this is how many years, then that's what the programming and planning envision. And that's typically the hardest part of what we're doing, is if missions want to do small one-off activities, they don't have that much money that is not tied to an earmark anymore. And so we call that discretionary funds. So anybody that would like to work on something that the host country would want is subject to discretionary funds unless it is an earmark. And like for us right now, the good news is global climate change is big and food security is big and water for the poor is big. And so for us, we are riding on funds that will go on at least in the medium term, and so we're able to program that money. Now, having said that, that's where the ag is just starting. I mean, USAID is just beginning with an ag strategy. And I don't think the ag strategy is finalized. I don't think it's ready to be released to the public yet. But that's kind of an example of the food crisis last year leads to food security program in aid, leads to years of funding, leads to us doing things that we used to do in the past.
Michael?
I would just say that I think Jim's point about long-term commitment is really important because much of what we've done in USDA is to build capacity through research and education. And if you don't have long-term commitments, you really can't – you struggle to embed that kind of educational process and to get the knowledge base up to a level where they can make use of the technologies that are out there. I think we heard earlier that you have to have that infrastructure to make it work, and that's a big step. And that's really how – USAID and USDA can partner together better is, you know, we need to have the infrastructure in place, but then that long-term commitment to research and education does pay off.
Now, a closely related question here, especially building on what Jim has just said about resources, is the whole nature of the current economic and financial crisis. I mean, obviously that contributes a little bit of a roller coaster effect to broader public commitments in these areas. How do you think the financial crisis will affect longer-range foreign assistance, and in particular, assistance involving water and agriculture?
As far as we know, it's not going to affect us in the near term because right now it's just starting on both water. The Millennium Development Goals are 2015 of having the people without access to water supply and sanitation. And so 2015 is kind of a marker, and people in Congress and special interest groups are realizing that the U.S. government hasn't done enough. And so I believe there's going to be an increased involvement and funding for us to 2015. Now, the agriculture thing started last year, and now aid is being criticized because we haven't been doing agriculture. And so I believe that the agriculture thing will run for a set period of time, at least until we get these longer-term programs up in place. I mean, if we're doing something like ag research and we're training people in other countries, these are programs of 3 to 5 year minimum time frame.
Fair enough. Now, I wanted to ask a question about the U.S. government writ large and relationships with other partners. To what extent is the government helping put together coalitions with new partners to deal with this? Is it leveraging its impact, and how can it help facilitate dialogues between companies, NGOs? We heard a little bit about this morning going forward. How would you describe the state of affairs there?
Well, we're looking better because our last administrator, Henrietta Fore, was trying to get global development alliances. She called it the Global Commons, of bringing more and more people together to do things because of the synergies and the multiplier effect, the money that comes in. And so USAID, as far as I know, is still looking at alliances, and it doesn't matter who our administrator will be. The main way we try to do business these days is trying to bring in other parties. Now, maybe the biggest disadvantage is that USAID is not involved in some of these organizations that have longer-running histories because we haven't been involved in that field. That means we don't put money into the organizations that need support. And so AID will have to reintroduce itself into some of those broader international organizations. So the things that we do in the private sector are much easier. I mean, Coke is doing a huge initiative with us, and Rotary has just started up a big initiative with us. And so bringing the private sector into these things is something that AID is focusing on. It's a little bit labor-intensive. I have a very small staff of people, and each one of these alliances takes some time and to get running. I think I'm not sure whether Rotary was 3 years to put together. And so each one of these takes a lot of effort. So the short answer is USAID is looking at all kinds of alliances and partnerships. There has been a sloughing off. I mean, we don't get together with the World Bank often enough. We don't have $200,000 to buy into some organization. And so it leaves us out of the discussion, away from the table, which isn't good. Now, again, I'm hopeful that this is going to be reversed.
As a point of information, I should note that Henrietta Holzman IV has rejoined the CSIS board, but I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, that she did not inspire me to ask that question. Michael, what would you like to add?
I would just, as I mentioned before, I think the opportunity to look at biotechnology as part of the solution, but only a part of the solution, is one that we can explore as a public-private partnership. There is sufficient industry momentum to kind of develop these products. We need to make sure that they're used responsibly in the right places with the right goals in mind, and also that this is a balanced approach. We need to get the science and education behind these products to know that they will be safe in the environment and that, in fact, they are to the advantage of those folks who would use them. So there are plenty of places where we can benefit from these public-private partnerships, and then the government agencies partnering better, I think, is another solution to that, using the expertise that we have available across the government in these bigger international development projects.
Well, Michael, building on that point, let's talk a little bit about the underlying technologies on both supply and demand side. There are a lot of interesting new technologies. A lot of them were raised in the context of this morning's discussion. First of all, how far do you think these kinds of technological improvements can carry us? We heard about drip irrigation, above ground, underground, other kinds of smart technologies coming online. How do you assess this? Where do you think it is? Where is it going? And what, and in terms of your own experience on the ground now, what are the key elements in play?
I think the irrigation efficiency can be improved quite a bit, but there are consequences if you just save the water and pass it to a junior water user. In the U.S., appropriation laws would actually make that water unavailable at the watershed scale. And so one of the challenges we face is as we become more and more efficient, the water that's applied is used completely and there's no leakage into the system, which used to sustain some of these other environmental kinds of benefits that we gain. And we will need to think about how water can be conserved at a basin-wide scale, not just field by field, farm by farm. So that's a technology improvement, but it's also a challenge for us to kind of rethink how we manage and appropriate water. On the biotechnology side, we probably will gain maybe 5 or 10% at the very most from new crops and new varieties that will save water or use saline water. But every 5% will make a difference. So I think that's a potential gain, but it's probably small in the long run. I think general just conservation and putting the right crops in the right places will do a lot more for us to save water than what we can gain by biotechnology or even irrigation efficiencies.
Jim, would you like to add to that?
Sure. I was in Jordan from 2001 to 2006, and we had a fairly wide-ranging program in Jordan. We could do pretty much whatever we wanted. We had we started demand management. The host country was opposed to demand management. The minister said, we don't want to spend money on this. He became a big supporter of demand management, and they reaped the benefits of that. We started a recycling. They said, no, you can't do recycling. Our water's too saline already, and you recycle, and it'll get more saline, and you won't be able to use this water for agriculture. Now they're big fans of recycling. And so a lot of these things, new technologies, you have to be patient, you have to show them, you have to do pilots, and it's my experience. I mean, we did something down in the Jordan Valley to show them if they just irrigated the root zone of the plant instead of flood irrigating and losing all that water down below the root zone, they save 15% water, they increase their production by 10%. And so many things like that. You have to show people that this works. You have to convince them that there other people are doing this for good reason, and you lead them, and they recognize the benefits of the program, and they get behind it, and then they become the person who thought of the idea.
Great. Let me ask two more questions, one for each of you, and then we'll open things up to general discussion. Michael, if you'll allow me to begin with you. Agricultural waste and runoff are clearly major contributors to, among other things, in terms of waterway pollution, illnesses that we are seeing take such an amazing human health toll across the world. USDA has worked with researchers in Delaware, we know, to remove chemicals from chicken feed, for example, to pollute waterways. How can we engage in kind of a broader effort to get these kind of positive results?
Well, we've focused on, I think, trying to use those demonstration projects and the research and education that would really extend our knowledge base to a variety of other countries. I think, we have technologies now to remove arsenic, for example, from chicken litter. We have technologies to use less nitrogen, and so those are out there and just need to be applied. I think part of this is we have to focus. Our efforts have always been on the technology, but we haven't really looked at the behavior of the people using these things. So we need to work more with farmers in terms of their behavioral sort of patterns. Why do they want to fertilize more? What's the impetus? And many times it's because in order to make their yield goals, they have to either irrigate more or fertilize more. Weather is the big unknown factor. And when that happens, they're forced to kind of make a decision early on in the season to either put fertilizer on or not. And we can actually do better in terms of managing that. I think the tools we need in the future are going to be ones that help us understand what the weather's going to be sooner and be able to manage those micronutrients or nutrients in the soil earlier on. That technology does exist, but getting the behavioral changes out there on the ground is really a major challenge. And it's not just a challenge in the developing world. It's a challenge right here in the United States. And we're working on that, but I think that's a slow process as, you know, most farmers are now over 60 years old and in the United States alone. So if that's the case, you know, we need a new generation of farmers that can actually use these technologies and understand how to implement them.
Thank you. And then, Jim, question for you. You've already mentioned how food security is now on the list. We had the Senator Paul Simon Water for the Poor Act before. Now, concern that we saw highlighted during the discussion this morning on global warming. How do we put this all together from an organizational standpoint, and how do you try to fit the pieces of the puzzle together as we think about food, water, energy, population pressures, and now global warming is another key variable?
Complicated question.
Yeah, big question, I know. We have some modelers here. I'm sure dying to hear what you have to say on that one.
The thing that gives us, I guess, the blessing and the curse is that we get an earmark, and it's called a directive. Some people don't like to hear earmark anymore. And the blessing is that that gives us money and it gives us support from special interest groups in the Hill to do this work. And so now global climate change is ramping up and food security, agriculture is ramping up. Now, the downside, the curse is that it puts blinders on us where we can't combine different programs and we can't do a biodiversity and form up a biodiversity and a water supply and an agriculture because they want the money in separate pots and they want the goals and the targets to be delineated for each of these. And so it's extremely complicated now for a mission to wind up saying we're going to do some water projects and they're going to impact these five different areas, which would have been the way we do business, integrated water resource management in the old days. And now, and that's why I say there's a watershed program, I believe it's in El Salvador, and they actually had to scrub out the water supply portion of that project because it was biodiversity money. And so you wind up getting one arm tied behind you instead of being able to work and accomplish two things at once. You are forced to just make your project focus on one part of the water cycle. And so like last year, our water money was just wash activities, and everyone was screaming in the field. And actually, Africa went from 20 million up to 100 million last year, but they were told after the fiscal year started that it was going from 20 to 100 million. And by the way, it can only be wash activities. Well, that created problems for a number of people because they didn't have extra money to do this program. And if they were planning on doing a water project, all of a sudden they had to shift their water project to do a water supply or sanitation program. And so these are the kind of things that we're trying to balance all the time. And so we have a global climate change team, and we have a water team, and we have a biodiversity team, and what we need to do is get them together all the time to be able to work like we know we should be working in the integrated fashion. And that if we do a project, we can have a priority, a primary goal for that project, but at the same time we accomplish these secondary ones. And so, like, for example, if you were going to do with the agriculture food security money right now, what you'd have to do is you'd have to show that that savings of agriculture efficiency turns over to a water supply in a city. And then you could say, okay, this is a WASH project and a food security project. But you have to track things that closely. You can't just free up water and say this benefits other portions of the water cycle. And so that's why I'm saying it's ridiculous if you're going to do a watershed program that you can't just take credit for cleaning up the water so you have better quality and better quantity downstream, and that translates for industry and municipal and agricultural and coastal and everything else. And so that's, you know, that I'm saying that it's a blessing and a curse, and we've learned to work around that system. And it creates that stovepiping that it enforces that stovepiping by financially handcuffing the projects.
Well, thank you both for addressing these questions, however inarticulate for me. Let's open up to a broader conversation here. Please, we'd like to hear from you. John, I was going to say, if you please stand up and identify yourself and your affiliation, but we already know John. Thank you.
I wanted to hear from Jim a little bit. It's to put it mildly, a sobering picture of bureaucratic constraints that you paint, and to me is really makes me very uncomfortable. When I look back at what we were talking about this morning, what the United States could do in the 60s, mm-hmm. when Pakistan had a huge security and development program, the United States brought the best of what it could. Now I hear an incredibly micro, you know, we deal with some refugee issues, the rest we can't deal with, or we have to jump through hundreds. So when we hear, for example, in the Pakistan area, the United States is now bringing together the security part, the development part. What I hear from you is count AID out of that, because AID does little things all over the place, is not a part of a big picture. If I want to link into the USDA, or I want to link in the Corps, I want to link in the big picture players who have a lot of knowledge in the United States, don't turn to USAID. Is that the correct conclusion
No.
I should come to?
Okay. No, not at all.
Glad to hear it. Yeah.
And so, again, we wind up working, and there are times, my last position, I've been in Washington for a year, my last position was in Afghanistan, and I went there and I was told, you're in charge of building roads and doing electricity. Well, I'm a water engineer, and I was told not to do water. And I know there's a desperate need in Afghanistan to do water. Well, I found a way to do some water programs in my spare time, and at the same time, there was an ag program. And so the ag program, and then we had a water team that formed up in the mission. And so the agriculture office was always coming over to me and telling me, we need, you know, your roads for access to market. We need your electricity, your energy for processing of these, even for the carpet makers that were sending their carpets to Pakistan to be clipped. And so there's a lot of synergies that are recognized in USAID. And that when you get a mission with money, like Afghanistan, then you have freedom to do many, many things. If you get a mission that has, say, $10 million, and say, for example, that four of them were earmarks, and then they're very narrowly defined programs on what they're going to do. So I believe the USAID can wind up still doing the same types of activities, but the only time you see them really breaking free is when there's a lot of money that allows it. And so aid still has the capacity to work like they did in the past. The unfortunate part, and that's why I say I don't really want to beat up on earmarks, because they're the reason that I have money to work on water. And people tend to think that I'm I don't know, disparaging that, the way I have to work. But at the same time, we do have opportunities. We have ways and means of breaking through these barriers they put in our way and accomplishing things. And, yes, we can. I'm sure there's going to be agriculture. There's going to be food security program in Pakistan, and there will be other things. And so I know there's health. I know there's education. I don't know what the other programs are going to be there, but all of these things kind of assume a life of their own, and many, many times they're based upon the highest level government interface that we have of a president asking our president or our secretary of state or our aid administrator, we need your support. And that's how it all translates into us getting involved and us being able to work on different activities. Now, just as far as back in Jordan, we had three programs, and one was economic growth, water, and health. And those were cross-cutting because water benefited the economic growth and the health and vice versa. And so there are many, many times when programs and missions put things together so that different parts of the program fit. And ideally, again, that's the way we should be working always.
I understand that we have an internet question from Jenny Lee is our gateway to the cyber world. So I have two questions, gentlemen. The first is, how does USAID work hand in hand with NGOs in implementing projects at the grassroots level? Any success stories? And the second is increasing use of eco-fuel a threat to food security? How should we use water efficiently, both for food and energy? Michael, would you like to begin on either one or both of those? Probably USAID. Jim would want to take on.
You take the second.
I can take the second one.
You want me to repeat it?
Yeah.
Is increasing use of eco-fuel a threat to food security, and how should we use water efficiently, both for food and energy?
I don't think it's entirely a threat to food security. I think one of the benefits of at least the biofuel production has been that it's elevated prices, which has given rural farmers a little bit more income, which is a good thing. The challenge is the amount of water that it takes to actually produce that crop. And so globally, we have to think about, you know, are we growing the right crops with that water in those areas where they can actually, you know, where there are markets for biofuels to sell those. I would hazard a guess that there is an upper limit for how much we can actually make out of soy oil or ethanol or something, and the cellulosic breakthrough has been promised for 3 decades and it hasn't happened, and so it's another decade away before we see that. So I do think there's a great benefit. I think the irrigation that's required to produce those kind of yields that they would like to get is the environmental challenge that we face. But I don't see a tremendous problem. And the economists would tell us that that's a good thing, that, you know, there's a market for these crops that provides income to rural farmers.
Thank you. Thank you. And Jim, USAID, NGOs, success stories.
We work with them all the time. I believe we have a new system that's working very well. It's called FACS. It's a computer that everything is fed into. And the fellow that works with me, Dan Dealey, that's responsible for getting his hands on all this information, is just in love with the FACS system now. Anyway, he is downloading all of this information. And the last time he downloaded our cooperating partners, contractors, grantees for cooperative agreements and grants, there were 170 firms, and most of them were very small amounts of money. And so almost all of the 170, the majority of them are PVOs and NGOs. And so, yes, we use them in many, many places. In Afghanistan, I was using them for construction, which I wouldn't, well, that isn't a typical way of doing construction. Usually you go through the private sector, because a grant agreement means there's a lot of freedom involved. If you give people money under a grant, they're free to go out and do things. And if you say, I'd like to build these roads, they're free to go out and build roads. But that doesn't mean I can go out and say, I don't like the roads you're building. And so anyway, USAID has many contracting mechanisms, and we use consultants, and we use contractors, and we use cooperative agreements, and we use grant agreements. in order to accomplish our business. And if you look at many things, health is probably the biggest thing. I would say primarily PBOs and NGOs. I would say the Global Health AIDS Initiative is probably mostly PBOs and NGOs working. So they play a large role.
We have time for one more question. Kellogg would...
Kellogg Schwab from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Perhaps a comment and then perhaps a question, too. I see integrated into all this a lot of public health as we go into now talking about agriculture issues. And I was encouraged to hear the land grants and the technology pushing in there, but there are other academic institutions besides land grants that are really pushing this forward and the links together into international health. Is there a mechanism, do you see, to go beyond just an NGO and into the academic side to try to bring in some of the research and cutting-edge technology to push these forward in an evidence-based approach so that we can then assess what's going on and then reevaluate perhaps more rapidly with respect to what the more positive outcomes and then perhaps even divert from some of these negative ones in there? That requires... from our side, some funding, and I know this is kind of a double-edged sword, but for us to really push this forward as well. So your thoughts on that would be appreciated.
We use universities all the time. I know Johns Hopkins works with our global health people. And so, again, land grants are just kind of a typical kind of thing. I'm not sure what the mechanism is that draws them in easier than others. But also there was the International Arid Lands Consortium, and that was a mix of land grant and other universities and research institutions. And so there is a whole array of universities and research facilities and everything else that are tapped by USAID. Washington State University was in Jordan for 30 years. And they were doing programs when I was working there. Now, they were doing training. They were doing training of the professors. They were doing twinning operations of professors and students coming back and forth. They were doing special research projects. And so it isn't a problem. It is a matter of the project manager or the mission or the office here in Washington recognizing an approach and getting ahead of the curve to solve something, to assess it, evaluate it, and make a recommendation so you don't keep doing the same thing every couple of years when this problem repeats itself.
All right. Well, with that, would you please join me in thanking these gentlemen for their contributions?